From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are some of you, like me, who fit into the age group that watched the wide world of sports in the 70s and saw Evel Knievel jump cars and buses on a motorcycle. Filmmaker Daniel Younge was at the tail end of this generation, and he says ever since he was a kid, he's wanted to make a film about Knievel. But the documentary he finally did make as an adult is probably different from the idea he had in mind when he was young. It's a darker story about a man who could be reckless and mean, neglectful and unfaithful. Younge says his film, which premiered at Sundance this year, is about reconciling his childhood hero with a real man. Today in the program, we continue our documentary series. Younge will join us to talk about his film called Being Evel. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Do you remember Evel Knievel? He was that daredevil who became famous in the 1970s for his stunts and his oversized personality. He jumped rows of cars or buses on a motorcycle in sports stadiums. He wore Elvis Presley-like costumes, capes and jumpsuits with big collars and big diamond rings. The filmmaker Daniel Younge says for a short period of time he was probably the most famous man in America. In Younge's new documentary film, we learn that Knievel himself knew why people tuned in to watch him on the wide world of sports. As he told a friend, it wasn't the takeoff on those stunts that brought the crowds. It was the landing, that possibility of disaster. Knievel was a childhood hero for kids of Daniel Younge's generation. They had Evel Knievel lunchboxes and played with Evel Knievel toys. He told kids to wear a helmet and said they could accomplish anything they put their mind to. But there's also a darker part of the story. His life was packed with contradictions and excess. And that's the story that Younge has captured. The film is called Being Evel, and today in the program, we're talking about it. We're screening the film on Thursday. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Daniel Younge is joining us. His film, Saving Face, won an Oscar for Best Documentary Short in 2011. Being Evel premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year, and we're going to be screening it, I already mentioned, in our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you details about that as we go along. Daniel Younge is joining us today from a studio in Los Angeles. And Daniel, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Well, let me begin this way. I know you've said, you've mentioned that you were sort of on the tail end of that, of Evel Knievel's sort of brief window of fame. What do you remember about him when you were a kid? What do you remember about those stunts and that wide world of sports and that stuff?
Yeah, you mentioned my generation. Now I'm becoming potentially aware of being that generation, an older, becoming older. I was on the tail end. I think the sweet spot right now is people anywhere from 45, where I am, up to 55. That seems to be, I mean, obviously Knievel meant so much to so many people and remained important to generations to follow. But there were those boys, and it was mostly boys, from my age up 10 years older than me, that he meant so much to us. He was our hero. And, you know, arguably alongside Muhammad Ali, was the most famous person in our country for a very, very short period of time.
Yeah, that, like, brief window. He was the biggest for just a short amount of time.
And our film looks into that. I mean, of course, it's a portrait of the man, but it's also a portrait of the times and why we needed this guy and why he rose like a phoenix and through some of his own self-destructiveness, why his the peak of his fame was so short-lived.
So there's this great story you've told about you went on a family vacation and you didn't you passed by the Snake River Canyon spot, that spot where Evel Knievel attempts
that
massive jump. Now, it wasn't the destination, you've said, for the vacation, but it meant enough for you guys to stop there.
Well, it meant enough to register with me, for me to remember any number of things that we saw on that trip. There's very few things that I recall. And being at the spot where Knievel went over the canyon was obviously impactful for me.
So you've mentioned that you've thought about a film about Evel Knievel since you were a kid. And there was probably that childhood hero part that you wanted to tell early on. But what was the film then that you imagined you would make compared to the film that you made?
In some ways, of course, because he's been in my consciousness for 40-some years, I wasn't aware of wanting to make a film, but he was back there in my consciousness. But then, when Knievel was arrested for assaulting his promoter, Shelley Saltman, which is a big part of our film, and went to jail, that was a moment especially for us kids that we couldn't quite figure it out. And so I grew up with a certain level of ambivalence. I still love the man. He's still my hero. But it was, there was all this icky stuff in my head I was trying to kind of sort out as a kid. And this, in essence, this film is kind of sorting that out as an adult, and hopefully sorting it out for viewers as well. And of course, we want people to come to their own conclusions. And I made the film with Johnny Knoxville, and Knoxville has his own conclusions. But what it means that this man meant so much to us and yet was still a very complex and oftentimes less than heroic man.
I wanted to ask you about Johnny Knoxville and his interest in it. Let me play a clip from the film first. This is Johnny Knoxville early on in the film. Let me play that. I want to talk a little bit about his role in all of this.
I didn't think of him as a daredevil. I thought of him as a superhero. No one ever went for it like that before. He invented that. Since then, it has taken off in a major way. That's such a large part of our culture now. He inspired all that. But there'll never be another Evel.
What do you figure was Knoxville's interest? Beyond the fact that he himself, he's part of the popular TV series and the films Jackass, and so he does his own kind of crazy stunts, and he gets that part of him. But it seems like it was kind of deeper than that, his interest, and wanting to know, as he says in the film, kind of that bigger story of the man.
Yeah, first of all, we were paired with Knoxville by our distributor, A&E. We're doing this under the History banner. It's History Films. And I'd probably be remiss to not say that it's coming out next Friday is when it opens.
Right.
I was paired with Knoxville, and at first I was like, huh? And then it took me about 3 seconds to go, oh, I get it. He's the conduit to the next generation. And then, of course, he's been so outspoken about his love for this man. What I didn't realize is that he has the same conflicted feelings about Knievel. He knows Knievel's backstory. And I also didn't recognize that he's a serious filmmaker, as serious a filmmaker as I've ever worked with. He must have looked at, to all of our 20 cuts of the film and gave notes to the frame. He was an intense producer and collaborator on the film. And I think that probably speaks to my naivete in terms of what I expected working with Johnny Knoxville, but it also speaks to his love of this guy and his desire to tell the full story. And you see him in the film, I think, in a way, a proxy for all of us, for all of our generation, kind of sorting out this very complicated story.
Did you worry at first when you first heard that you were going to be collaborating, or could potentially be collaborating with Johnny Knoxville, that this was going to be just kind of a simple-minded sort of thing that was going to be more about the stunts? I mean, did you worry about that early on?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, sure I did. And I think I also have a worry that people are going to see his face and name on it and jump to some conclusions.
Yeah.
But I think those people either, A, don't recognize what a very serious filmmaker he is, and he's done other documentaries, and also that they, that if it doesn't take you long into this film to realize that you're going to go on a journey more than just thrills and chills, although there's our share of those in the film, that, you know, that they recognize. I mean, the film premiere at the Sundance Film Festival, I think that speaks somewhat to the, you know, to the gravity with which we're approaching the subject.
Well, let's talk about his life. You go back to, as Johnny says in the film, you kind of have to go back to the start. You have to go back to Butte, Montana, where he's raised by his grandparents, because his parents kind of split early on. So there's this kind of anger that helps understand a lot about it. And I want to play a clip from the film. This is his cousin, Pat Williams. And some may recognize that name. He was a Democratic congressman from Montana for a few years. And he's featured in the film. He's great in the film. And he tells this story. I want to play this and I want to talk about it because I think it reveals something about who Robert Knievel, Evel Knievel, really was. Here's Pat Williams from the film Being Evil.
We were up at my grandma's house, and he and I were wrestling around, and I punched him in the mouth, and he lit on the back of his head, and I said, "Bobby," and nothing. I thought, "Oh, my God, I killed him." And instantly, he had these wild eyes because he knew what had happened. And across the kitchen, there was a door that was slightly open, a pantry door, and he ran at that door and slammed it shut with his head. And that half stunned him again, and he turned around, sitting down, and he pointed at me and he said, "Did you see that? Nobody can hurt me. You can't hurt me. Nobody can hurt me."
Daniel Youngie, what do you think that says about Evel?
Well, I think it's very telling. I mean, first of all, it's very Knievel. You know, on the yeah. surface, it could be considered a little funny and thrilling and chilling, and the fact that it has this physical bravado in it, and you can see the young Knievel in that. But you can also see the anger, which foments and definitely is part of the film. But moreover, and I don't want to read too much into it, but there's a tragic story here. I think Knievel is an American tragedy as much as an American hero story. And I think in many ways he was searching for his father. It's a classic trying to please the father who's not there yeah. story. And, you can see this kid who you sympathize with. And I think that's important in the film because later when Knievel is less than sympathetic, hopefully you can understand what brought him there. And there's more than a little rosebud in yeah. this story. If
totally.
You know what I mean.
Yeah, that's so true. And there's a moment, Frank Gifford, who by the way, just died yesterday. He's featured in the film.
Just passed away yesterday. Yeah. Rest in peace, Frank.
Yeah. He says something really important, I think. It was just this brief moment in your film. He says that he wanted to be loved, Robert Knievel.
Sure. It's pretty profound, isn't it? I mean, we think of guys like Knievel and maybe Knoxville to some degree, although I don't want to put him there. But, that we think of them just as wanting attention, and we want to simplify that. But in a way, it's certainly for Knievel, it was a way of wanting to be loved and accepted. Some of us don't have the tools to receive love in the same way that other people do. And Knievel just sought it in a very extreme manner.
It's interesting, too, the way Butte, Montana, was a part of who he was. And in a lot of ways, at least that early section of the film, it's about what it meant to grow up in a small Western town, I think. You know, this idea of fighting, trying to prove yourself in some way,
yeah,
too.
I think in an old West town in a lot of ways, because I mean I grew up in Cheyenne, Wyoming, which by has this mystique in terms of what people back east might think of it. It was definitely much more of a suburban atmosphere, and I think a lot of the towns in the West that have Flagstone, that have this kind of old West mystique, don't have it anymore. Butte did,
yes.
And to some degree, Butte still does, and that's because it was absolutely a mining town. It was a huge mining town, and it had all these different class of citizens and different ethnicities. And you did have to fight your way up and out, and that was not only expected and necessary, but it was praised to some degree. And I think that Knievel came out of that cauldron, and that definitely informed who he was as an adult. It doesn't apologize for some of the stuff he does, and there's even people in the film in Butte that, you know, when Knievel did certain things, they said, "That's not Butte."
Right.
But It is Butte to some degree. I think that where he came from informs who he was as an adult. And furthermore, to imagine that he's arguably the most famous man in America. He's on Johnny Carson. He's obviously has all this charisma and he's a raconteur, but bear in mind he came from this tiny place where bravado and gusto ruled the day.
I want to ask you about Linda Bork, who becomes Linda Knievel. They get married. It's a great story, but I'm not sure how much of it is true, where he sort of kidnaps her on the street, takes her to Dillon, Montana, and marries her. But she's such an interesting figure in the film. There's the kind of reluctance almost. They go through a very rough they get divorced. He goes through this period of just crazy cheating on her constantly, which you reveal. Mm-hmm. This is one of the darker elements of the story. But mm-hmm. I wanted to know what the conversation was like with her, getting her to talk. She's honest about it. But there's this kind of sadness or reluctance that you also sense in her interviews.
Yeah. No, first of all, some of the most surprising moments for me as a filmmaker were that some of the people who should be the most indicting of Knievel are some of the most forgiving people in the film. And some of those who loved him the most are the most brutally honest, and top of that list would be Linda. First of all, I just applaud her for being taking part in the film. She's very reclusive, and clearly she had a difficult life with Evil. I think that one of the most painful interviews I've conducted, because some of those chapters were so difficult, and I'm asking her to relive them. I mean, on the nice side, she really enjoys her life now. I'm sure she's remorseful for the death of her ex-husband, but she is definitely in her golden age and is really enjoying her life as a single woman with her kids and grandkids. But she, he put her through the ringer. He was not an easy husband at all. And you sense that in the film. Well, you get it directly from the comments, but then under that, you can sense how difficult her life was with him.
That's what I liked about her section, was it was less what she said, because she was very straightforward and kind of curt sometimes in her responses. But you got a sense that sort of in her eyes, how deeply she felt about all of that and how painful that whole experience may have been, I think.
Well, she's curt because she's a humble woman. Yeah. And she doesn't want to berate him, but you can tell in her very short clipped answers that the pain behind some of those moments. I want to emphasize that it's a dark film and there's some darkness to the story, but that, this guy was also an unbelievable raconteur and charismatic, and there's a reason why we all loved him, and that's definitely explored in the film too. So hopefully there's a push-pull in the film, that when you feel like you're being pulled too much to the dark side, you can definitely see why we loved him and why we needed him as well. We needed this man at that point in our history.
Well, and we should point out that it's an incredibly funny film.
It sounds like a laugh riot, doesn't it?
Well, right now it sort of does, right? But we should point that out, that he was a character. He was crazy. Uh-huh. And he goes through these stunts, obviously. We know about a lot of them, but the early days of the stunts were really, really funny. He starts selling Honda motorcycles in Washington State at some point in his early part of his life. And he's not making enough money at that point, at least from his point of view. It was probably a decent living, but it wasn't enough. He wasn't in the limelight. He wasn't, it wasn't the life that he wanted. So he conceives of this kind of first stunt to get people to come and pay attention to the motorcycles that he's selling. And this is when he has the idea of doing a jump. And he wants to jump over cougars and rattlesnakes. I mean, that's like the first, idea. And so there's this story that he tells, and I want to play a clip. Ray Gunn, childhood friend of his, who's with him for a long time. And is it Gary Frey? Is that how he?
Frey.
Gary Frey. And this gives you a sense of sort of the other side of that story. This is from the film, Being Evil.
Well, my part in that mountain lion jump was I wore a white coat like a doctor, and Evil introduced me as a veterinarian, which was a crock of bull. But
so he brings him down and put the cougars underneath, and they're scared to death. They won't come out.
They're like kitty cats.
But the snakes, holy Christ, we put them in a big refrigerator carton, and they were pissed off. So he goes around the track, and then he goes up the ramp, and, well, the minute he went up in the air, I could see he wasn't going to make it. By God, he's about 3 feet short. His back tire hits a refrigerator carton. The tapes go flipping into the crowd. Talk about people running and getting out of there. Jesus Christ. The poor guy from Vantage wants us to help catch his snakes. You gotta be kidding me.
And he just rode back on his motorcycle, went up the jump and waved at the crowd. He didn't care about the snakes.
People started to talk to him, what can you do next? And he started thinking about that kind of stuff.
From the film Being Evil, Ray Gunn, his friend, says he had some weird ideas about how life should be lived. Do you have a sense of what he meant by that? How did he conceive of his life beyond it just being sort of these crazy stunts? I mean, what was the bigger theme, do you think? Do you think you understand that now?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think what can be gleaned from that scene is first and foremost, the jump only – Knievel figured out very quickly that the jump lasts, milliseconds. The spectacle, it was all about the spectacle. And cougars and rattlesnakes was the spectacle of that first jump. And he figured out different ways to create spectacle later in his life. And also that at the end of the day, no matter what the, fallout and detritus was from his jumps, it was about him, that the story was about Knievel, and that he was out in front of anything else that would be perceived in around his events. And then also the fact that the people said, well, what are you going to do next? That this was generating interest right away. Ray says he lived his life that he was weird in a way. And Ray's speaking euphemistically. I mean, what he's saying, and that's in regards to some of Knievel's earlier carousing and scandals in his life.
Shady.
And he's being euphemistic and saying Knievel was out for Knievel. That was the number one person that Knievel cared about, and that he had very. And I think some of us have individuals like this in our life who have ways of creating spectacle around themselves and who are about a relentless promotion of themselves, and whether that manifests in becoming, the world's best insurance salesman, which Knievel also was, film points out, or whether it means, jumping over 12 Greyhound buses, then in essence, it's the same kind of the weirdness that Gunn is talking about.
Daniel Youngie is with us. He directed the documentary film Being Evil, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. On Thursday night, we're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Daniel is going to be joining us there for a Q&A after the film. We should point out that seating for the show is limited, so you should get there early. KUER members, and if you bring your membership card, you'll get early access. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling a new documentary that premiered at Sundance this year. It tells the story of Evel Knievel. Daniel Youngie is with us to talk a little bit about the film, explain why he was the most famous man in America for a brief moment. We're screening the film on Thursday. We'll give you details a little bit later about that. Daniel Youngie is going to join us, by the way, for a Q&A after that film. I guess we should point out, Daniel Youngie, that just how actually talented he was, or at least seemed to me, on a motorcycle. I mean, I mean, these days it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal to jump, you know, 19 Greyhound buses. But if you think about like, there was no technology for that sort of thing. The bikes were super heavy, bulky. He must have been really good at what he did on some level. It didn't really occur to me until I was watching the film.
Yeah, he was a great athlete, as we document in the early part of the film. He could have probably been a professional hockey player or a ski jumper, which was his first kind of daredevil avocation. He was athletic and he was strong. His ability to control the motorcycle, this huge, you know, dump truck is what it really was, more than a motorcycle, or more than a jumping motorcycle that we think of today, was his upper body strength. But at the end of the day, he was nothing compared to the jumpers we have now.
Yeah.
In terms of his. Not only his athletic ability and his preparation, is there was nothing compared to what we see now or the equipment that we see now. But you have to imagine that this stuff had never been dreamed up before. Mm-hmm. So he's considering whether it's possible. And I think that's what we have to bear in mind, is that this guy was doing, you know, that he was, you could single-handedly credit him for the birth of extreme, what we call extreme sports.
Yeah.
That people didn't imagine doing this stuff, and he did, and he saw the spectacle in it. So that, as much as his athleticism, I think needs to be credited, the idea of dreaming it up.
And it dovetails so perfectly with the emergence of the wide world of sports on ABC.
Yeah, it was a perfect marriage.
It was a perfect marriage because, like, Doug Wilson, who's great. I love that he wore his old wide world of sports jacket on the
bright
interviews.
Bright yellow.
Yeah.
It's a little less bright than it probably was 40 years ago.
I'll bet so, but it's so great. And he's terrific in the film, too. And he talks about how that in those days they were sort of in the business of sports theater. That's, you know, the agony of defeat. So, you know, this was all about drama. And so, as you said, they come together at this sort of perfect time. And then you also talked about how the it wasn't just the jump, which took, you know, a few seconds, if that. It was the setup to it, and it leads us to this really great, one of the most famous jumps, I think, in his career, at least in my mind, was the Caesar's Palace stunt or jump. Talk a little bit about this, because this was, I think this really made him, don't you think, in some ways?
Yeah, well, first of all, wide world of sports, I mean, from a practical standpoint, they didn't have any money. And so they couldn't do the traditional, you know, football, basketball, baseball. And they had to fill these hours. And so what they did is put a lot of weird, wacky stuff that some of which you know, was like the very early skateboarding and ski jumping and barrel racing and all this weird stuff. And so Knievel was kind of thrown into that weird stuff and cheap to get, you know, motorcycle races, and then Knievel was part of the package. So it was really from a practical standpoint, but we kids fell in love with that and we tuned in and they made it into theater. And Knievel was the very, you know, he was the height of this the theatricality of wide world of sports, because at the end of the day, he could live or die on this jump.
Yeah.
And he posed it that way. So he did a couple of jumps on Wide World of Sports, and that's when he cooked up the idea of jumping the fountains. And as we point out in the film, it's one of those things that he cooked up and sold as he was the consummate salesman. He cooked up and sold before he actually figured out whether it was possible. And on the day, you know, I think we know, I'm not giving away too much to know that it on that given day, it was not possible. And he had his first horrific accident, and that ironically cemented his fame.
It's a piece of film that you've probably seen, listeners. It's that image of, and it's, you see it, we see it a couple of times in the film. He's basically a rag doll. It's a horrific crash.
Horrific.
It's really amazing. When you think about it, like, I've actually never seen it full speed. I wonder what that looks like, because you see it's like the rag doll image. But this, I guess this image, this also sort of cements who he is. And he probably knew that because he really plays this up.
He certainly does. And that's, again, the showman in him. I think he recognized that that was going to cement his fame and that people were tuning in and people were playing it over and over again. You know, it went viral before we knew what that meant. And I think he played. I mean, clearly he was seriously injured in that crash. But he played it up as if he was on death's door, which was also part of the Knievel mystique, and also a little bit of the, you know, Knievel solipsism that he had. You know, he liked to focus on his woes, and I think that really brought him into the public consciousness. And again, you know, we talk in the film about us needing this guy, and we were ready for this guy who would defy death, and Caesar's Palace showed that he was willing to do that.
Yeah. You mentioned how he sort of switches into, as Johnny Knoxville says in the film, switches into hustler mode, trying to get people to pay attention and trying to get Caesar's Palace to let him do this. I want to play a clip here. We'll hear Johnny Knoxville in this clip. But we'll also hear Evel Knievel telling the story of trying to get people to pay attention to this, because he calls up the owner of Caesar's Palace, pretending he's these different sports writers trying to gin up interest. Here's a clip from Being Evil.
This guy called every news outlet, told him that Evel Knievel, famed as stunt motorcyclist, was going to jump Caesar's Palace come Saturday morning. Be there.
So then he calls Jay Sarno, the guy who runs Caesars. And each time he would call as a different person, and each time he would mispronounce his own name.
I told him my name was Larson. I was with Sports Illustrated. I said, "You ever heard of Evel Knievel?" He said, "Evel Knievel? Who the hell's this Evel Knievel?" So I waited two more days, and I called him back up. I said, "This is Dennis Lewin from Wide World Sports. Do you know Evel Knievel?" He says, "Evel Knievel, Evel Knievel, Evel Knievel. Who is this crazy guy?" He said, "Everybody's calling me up about him." He said, "I think we got a deal with him. I don't know. Call back."
Like a lot of his stunts, Caesar's Palace was one of those that he dreamed up and sold before he even knew it was possible. And then on the day, he's got the crowds there, and he doesn't know if he can make it. He's just got to go for it.
Daniel Yonge, it's almost like, and this seems like a theme in his life, where he just sort of tosses his hat over the wall without thinking about it, and he has to go retrieve it. Like, he does all the setup first, almost as if that was part of the scheme. It's like, I'm just going to tell people what I'm going to do, and then I'm forced in some ways to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, you could dismiss that as hucksterism. You could dismiss it as being, ill-advised and imprudent, but he's the consummate American. You know, yeah. He's the guy who wills it into existence and says, "Why not? Why don't I do this? No one's stopping me, and I think I can do it, and thus I can."
Yeah.
That's admirable too. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is what we're made of as Americans. And I don't want to get too much into, you know, American exceptionalism, but that's what, if you believe we're great, that's what makes us great.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think there's a certain, and hopefully we play that line in the film, that we're walking that line, that there's a certain moment where, you know, this is not in the film, but at one point when Knievel was after the Snake River Folly, was trying to figure out a way to jump out of an airplane and land in a haystack. Now, so there's it taken to the extremes, it's absurd. But also, before he was jumping over 12 buses, if you imagined a guy jump in a motorcycle over 12 buses or jump in a rocket over a canyon, you'd say that can't be done. And he proved us wrong, almost.
You know, there's and this is kind of a theme in the one of the themes anyway in the film, this idea that Pat Williams, his cousin, former congressman, mentions that Evel Knievel captures just what the country needed at that time. Explain a little bit about that, because there's war, there's corruption. George Hamilton says, you know, we're coming apart at the seams as a country.
Yeah, I think suffice to say that we're still in Vietnam. There's Watergate. I mean, we're at a real low point for our country. And I remember as a kid, I remember gas lines, and I remember the Iran hostage situation, which, of course, that comes slightly after the story that we're telling here. But it was part of the 70s malaise that I remember as a kid. And I grew up as a kid knowing that we were great as a country, but also thinking there were things that were not so great, and that kind of ambivalence that we had as a kid, you know, someone like Evel Knievel made us forget all that and know that, you know, this guy was wrapped in the stars and stripes, and he was doing great things, and he was willing himself into existence, and that I think was a powerful message for us kids.
As we head into a break, let me play another film, clip from the film. This is Pat Williams, and Earl Casting is a friend of Evel Knievel from the film Being Evil. Must be the season
of the we were a little down on ourselves. And along comes this kid from Butte, Montana, who showed us who we were and wanted to be again.
He wears red, white, and blue, stars and stripes too.
I guess we were looking for some sort of a hero. We had Superman and Batman, and but this guy was the real thing.
Evel Knievel's for God and country too.
From the film Being Evil, and you can tell there's a lot of great music in the film. The director Daniel Young is with us.
That's Knoxville too, by the way. He for those of you who don't know it, he's also a DJ and is a consummate music guy and helped place some choice pieces in the film.
There's a lot of good music in the film. I mean, that must have been a good budget line item too, trying to license all this stuff.
It was, yeah. Well, if you had seen the rough cut, there was even more great music in the film, but at some point you have to start pulling it back.
Yeah. Daniel Young is with us. Being Evil is his film. We're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center as part of our Through the Lens series. The film opens nationwide on Friday, but you'll get an early shot at it on Thursday. Come early. Daniel's going to be with us for a Q&A after. Seating is limited. You can get details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with filmmaker Daniel Young. We're talking about his new film, his new documentary film, Being Evil, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. It opens on Friday. On Thursday, you'll have an early shot at it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series. Daniel's going to be with us talking about the film.
It actually opens the following Friday.
Following
the 21st,
Friday. Oh, okay.
In theaters and on digital platforms, iTunes,
okay.
And on demand.
Good. All right. I'll clear that up. So you get an extra week before it opens if you want to come on Thursday. So as I said, come early if you're going to be there. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. So I wanted to ask you about let me just play a clip. This is Evel Knievel himself. This is on the Dick Cavett Show, and Cavett asks him an important question, and I wanted to talk a little bit about his response.
Are you scared before a stunt? Do you have fear?
I am not scared. When I go off of that jump, I'll say I have some concern, but I don't think I've ever been afraid of anything. If I know something's going to happen, I try and train myself to where I have complete control over my mind and my body. I relax when I hit instead of freezing up and being scared.
Do you believe it? Do you think that's ever been true in his life?
No, I don't entirely believe it, and I'll leave it to audiences to decide. Yeah. But I was able to ask a lot of people in the film, like Tony Hawk is in the film, and Matt Hoffman is one of our producers in the film, and even Knoxville, who does, you know, their wacky stunts, but some of them are pretty pretty crazy.
Yeah.
All of them experience fear to some degree, but they have a way to you know, to subjugate that and to control it. And I think that's what Knievel was able to do. But I absolutely think he felt fear, and you see it in the film when he's approaching some of his biggest jumps and he's confiding in his friends and colleagues who are in the film. They admit that he was afraid. How could you not be? I certainly don't think of him any less for having fear, and I don't think of him any less for saying he doesn't have fear, because that was the Knievel mystique. But I do feel like if you do this night in and night out, which he did earlier in his career, and then, but even you know, several times a year later in his career, if you're facing death and you're not admitting to any fear, I think that and if people are coming, literally, some people are coming to watch you die, I think that takes a psychic toll. Yeah. And the film, I think, documents the psychic toll this took on Knievel and helped contribute to some of his, you know, less than chivalrous activities.
Right. That whole story of the Snake River Canyon jump, I think, reveals so much about Evel Knievel, and the stakes are so high. He really puts the stakes high because of his behavior. And you show in the film how the sense of, I don't know if it's fear, but certainly anxiety or whatever it was, begins to kind of overtake him in the Snake River Canyon jump. He becomes angry and he becomes surly. Let me play another clip here. I mean, things start going south with the press about a week out, you say, in the film. And Knievel he turns on them. And he attacks, as you'll hear in the story, Jim Watt, an NBC cameraman at the time.
Do one thing for me. I do not ask for your respect. I demand it.
Shelley gathered everybody around Evel's trailer and says, why don't you just have him stand up so we can see, you know? Because there was a big crowd of people there. And Evel heard that and came out and...
I'm not an actor, Mr. Cameraman. Do you understand that?
I said have a smile on your face.
I don't smile on anybody.
All right, get him out. Get him out. Out. Go on, get out of here.
That's when he came down the stairs with his cane. He grabbed my camera, and he's a pretty strong guy. And grabbed my camera and started pushing me back and whacking me and the camera with his cane.
Are you going to apologize to that cameraman for roughing him up?
I wouldn't apologize, and if I see the little son of a bitch again, I'll throw him out of here. How's that?
As hard as we tried, a lot of Evel's true temperament came out to the press.
I think you should apologize.
Well, I want to straighten you out right now. Number one, I was in the Sky Cycle all day. Number two, you were a guest of mine in my press area. Do you understand that? And so was he. Number three, when I've been up there all day and that blood's come out of my legs and my feet and gone to my head, and I come down to want to get some rest and get along with you people, you don't tell me to come out and stand up and smile. If I want to come out and try and get along with you, you should at least allow me to sit down and smile. So tell him I said to kiss my ass.
That was such a remarkable, that whole week or couple of weeks there, I think, was so amazing. And one thing I had not realized is what a melee it became. I mean, it was a dark version of of Woodstock. I had no idea. That was a really amazing story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was a spectacle run amok. And it's funny, as you play that clip now, I'm remembering that, I mean, there's obviously some pretty vile stuff in there, and he was, I think behaving less than heroically there in moments. But then I also remember that one of the last extractions from the film was his son Kelly saying, "Remember, this guy is a small town guy from Butte, Montana, who became the most famous man in America within a matter of months," and. If you imagine that he's created this incredible spectacle, now he has to live inside of it, and now he has to live up to the spectacle. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we call the film Being Evel for a number of reasons, that he's got to be that guy. And again, that takes a psychic toll, and I think that he was cracking. And so, in a way, I can't condemn him. I think he was. Yeah. I think he. It's part of the tragic story of Evel that he is. Created this maelstrom, and he needs to live at the center of it. And he's supposed to be this chivalrous you know, this chivalrous hero. And then there was one other thing that's kind of happening in the film. We talk about, you know, we discuss how we needed him as a country, and maybe he'd outgrow, you know, there's a comment coming up in the film where maybe he had outgrown his novelty.
Yeah.
And maybe we had started to grow past him. And some of us kids were maybe maturing past the need to have an evil in our lives. And that's also part of the tragic circumstances of evil's story.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end of the day, it was just this crazy event that he had concocted. And now he needed to get into this tin can, for lack of better words, and try to go a mile over the Snake River and live. And that, I mean, that is death-defying by definition.
Yeah. I have to say, it's for all the stunts that he did, all the jumps that he did, this seemed the most completely insane. And I think the way you build it in the film, you get a sense that he probably thinks he's going to die. But he doesn't think he can back out.
It had been billed as the death-defying stunt of the century, and he was a promotional genius and billed it that way. But sooner or later, that's got to seep into your subconscious. You know that, okay, this is it. I am going to die. And when he pulls his kids, who talk about it, into the trailer just before the jump, you know, it's probably the most grave moment that they'd ever faced with him. And he spoke to them as if a man who was going to the gallows. Which you see when he steps up to the rocket, it looks like a gallows. You know, I think it's we were all mesmerized with the thrills and chills aspect of it. But you know, a man facing death also has, you know, a certain amount of sobriety to it as well.
Yeah, for sure. And then we turn on him. Certainly the press turns on him. There are these big questions about whether he was a daredevil or a fraud because of – and I won't go into all the details. I'll leave it to people to see the particulars of how that story plays out. And it seems like he sort of fades off for a while, and then the 90s come where the emergence of action sports comes on, or extreme sports, or whatever you want to call it, takes off, and it transforms, you know, as you say in the film, it's pointed out, from, you know, these – being daredevils to professionals. And for a lot of these guys, like Johnny and Tony Hawk and a lot of the other people, because there are a few of them who are doing these stunts that are featured in the film, for a lot of these guys, Evel Knievel is that, what do they put it? He's sort of the basis. He's the foundation for this emergence of action sports.
Yeah, you see, there's a ESPN Sports Awards show where they call him the OG. And
right.
he is the OG.
Yeah.
Of extreme sports, and we have to truncate that history to some degree. There were certainly Robbie Knievel took, you know, his son picked up where he left off, and there were many, many other emulators in the motorcycle jumping realm. But then there's a whole generation, really, that starts with the boys my age and girls my age, who said, you know, to hell with convention. I think I can do this because Evel Knievel, you know, said he could do it and did it. Why can't I? And yeah. I think that's when you start seeing not just motorcycle jumpers, but all kinds of extreme activities that that parents probably were not happy with their kids doing, but now some of those kids are going on to make millions doing.
You know, it made me wonder. The film made me wonder when you look at George Hamilton's experience trying to he made a film, some of you may have seen it, of Evel Knievel's life. Evel wasn't crazy about it, didn't like sharing the spotlight, I guess. And then Shelley Saltman writes this book that he thinks is quite honest, and Evel goes after him, literally attacks him with a baseball bat. And it made me wonder, what do you think Evel Knievel would have made of your documentary if he were still alive?
He would have loved being back in the spotlight, and certainly our documentary is not the only one which is doing that. There's many other docs and books and now products which put him in the spotlight, and he would appreciate what he's meant to this culture. But no, I think he created an image of himself that was unblemished and untarnished, And certainly we're showing the whole reality there. And I don't know. I think he would want to kick my ass. He'd probably
he would have. There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, he was, and it was because every attempt he wanted to be in control. I think that's what it was about. Don't you think?
Yeah. No, he was a control freak for sure. And you couldn't achieve what he's achieved without being that kind of individual. But I will say that, I mean, his family shares some of his traits, and his sons have the same bravado, and the family has been mostly supportive of the film, which we love, and I think they appreciate the warts and all look. But also, at the end of the day, I want to emphasize, you know, this film is paying homage to this guy who meant so much to Knoxville and to myself. We're not here to denigrate him. We're here to tell the whole story and then ultimately try to explain why we love him so much. And hopefully the film does that.
There's one. Let me play one final moment from the film. This is Robert Knievel, Evel Knievel himself, because I think this expresses an important theme to me anyway about what it was about. And this one of his friends says in the end, you know, most of us don't take chances in our lives. And really, Evel Knievel did. Here's another moment from the film Being Evil.
To be something a little extra special, no matter what I want to do, if I like to do it, to be a champion or to be the best, even though I've been hurt so many times, then live like a lot of people do, that live in a gray twilight world, that these kind of people, they don't even know victory or defeat because they've never tried anything. And this is something that I feel compelled to do, and I'm going to do it.
I think that's an important theme in the story. And I wanted to ask you about, I'm not going to ask you about a final shot that you make at the Snake River Canyon. I'll leave that for other people. It's kind of this moment of redemption. It's a nice image, and I don't want to give it away. Daniel Younge directed the documentary film Being Evil, which premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. This Thursday evening, we're screening the film. It opens not this Friday, but next Friday nationwide. But you can see it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center, part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Daniel's going to be with us for the Q&A after the film. I'll point out again, seating is limited, so plan on arriving early. You can get details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Daniel Younge, thank you very much. Congratulations.
Thanks, Doug, and look forward to seeing everyone Thursday.
Great. Radio West, production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Daniel Lombardi. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.